Welcome back to another month of the PigX podcast. I'm your host, Delaney Howell. On today's episode, we hear about the importance of pelvic organ prolapse, also known as POP. We will talk about why it has increased average mortality, what factors like heritability contribute to POP, and ways breeders and producers can reduce the risk of prolapse through nutrition and management. The conversation today will be led by industry experts, including Dr. Jack Deckers, a distinguished professor of animal breeding and genetics at Iowa State University, and Dr. Janelle Dunkelberger, a geneticist with Topix Norsfin. In addition, you'll hear about a PhD student that contributed to some past research that has helped the industry today. Let's first hear Dr. Deckers and Dr. Dunkelberger's connections to the swine industry.
Thank you, Delaney, for having us on. Looking forward to having the conversation with you today. My name is Janelle Dunkelberger. I live in Minnesota, just outside of the Twin Cities, and I've been based here for about 7.5 years now, since joining Topix Norsfin upon graduating from grad school. So completed my PhD at Iowa State, actually under the supervision of Jack. So he was my major professor in grad school. In the topic of my thesis work, I was looking at the role of host genetics in response to viral disease in pigs. So heavy emphasis on PRRS and genes and genomic regions associated with a natural robustness and resilience to PRRS challenge. So actually, I still spend a lot of time investigating PRRS and the role of the host genome in response to PRRS and other diseases in my position as the head of the Global Health and Behavior Research Platform for Topix Norsfin. And so still looking at trying to identify genetic solutions for disease resistance.
Great. Thanks for that background. Jack, what about you?
Yeah, Jack Deckers. I'm a professor at Iowa State University in the Department of Animal Science, and I've been here now 27 years. I'm originally from the Netherlands, can still hear my accent, but I did my PhD at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, working on dairy cattle breeding and genetics, and then spent about 8 years at the University of Guelph in Canada, also working on dairy cattle, and then when I moved here to Iowa State, switched to working on primarily on swine breeding, but also some work on poultry breeding, and part of the focus has been on feed efficiency in pigs and then also disease resilience. And as Janelle mentioned, we've done quite a bit of work on PRRS, resistance to PRRS, and the genetic basis of that, together with Joan Lunny at USDA and Bob Rowland when he was still at Kansas State University. That's now developed further into more general disease resilience, including this work on pelvic organ prolapse. So that's a bit of my background.
Perfect. So that's a good segue into, first, I'd like to just start out with what is pelvic organ prolapse and maybe what causes it. And then I think we can get into a little bit more of some of the research that's been done since 2019, 2020.
Yes, this term of pelvic organ prolapse, or POP, as we'll refer to it throughout the conversation, is not going to be a new term for the listeners on this podcast, I imagine, because it's been a pretty hot topic in the industry for the past number of years now. The reason for that being that we've seen this kind of steady increase in sow mortality since around 2013, 2014, right, where we see this increase in the average sow mortality across the industry since that time. The reason for this increase in sow mortality seems to be pretty consistently due to one of three reasons that are kind of ranking towards the top. So POP being one of those reasons, also feet and leg structure, and unknown or other. So depending on the production system, now, the order of those three might change, but they kind of tend to be consistently the top three main reasons for sow death loss within a system. So since the last decade, this 2013-2014 timeframe, there has been a lot of attention on trying to understand what these potential causes are of POP. as it's a pretty devastating issue to observe at the farm level and certainly has a really large economic impact on production. I've heard a lot of different suspected causes throughout that time, you know, from things like mycotoxins, water intake and quality. Diet composition has also been suspected to be involved, whether it's a vitamin or a mineral deficiency, maybe even the ratio of different vitamins and minerals included within a diet. But we really didn't have a lot of concrete information or evidence in terms of what suspected causes were really involved until Jason Ross launched this pelvic organ prolapse project from Iowa State in around 2019. So probably as many of the listeners are aware, that was a large project involving data collected from, I think it was over like 100 different farms with all kinds of variables that were evaluated as potential risk factors for prolapse. From that analysis, he identified four that actually had a statistically significant effect on prolapse, including bump feeding strategy, the water treatment method, and perineal score and body condition. So that was kind of the first round of evidence, I think, that we received in terms of factors that we could say were really having an impact on POP. In subsequent conversations with Jason, you know, it became clear that genetics was another one of these factors that was being discussed and deliberated throughout the industry. But that particular project and data set was not suitable to investigate a potential genetic component for POP. So that's kind of what prompted us as an organization to want to dig into that further and see if we could conduct our own investigation to quantifying a potential genetic component for POP.
Yeah, maybe if I can answer this large project that Jason Ross led was funded by the National Pork Board and the Foundation for Food and Agricultural Research, and also, you know, involved people from Iowa State, from Animal Science, the Vet College, but also people from Kansas State and other places, looking at all kinds of different aspects, not only of pelvic organ prolapse, but also in general, sow and piglet and pig survivability. And that's actually being renewed now. So we got a renewal funding from the National Pork Board and also hoping to get the additional funding from the Foundation for Food and Agriculture Research. And the other interesting thing about prolapse, it's a big issue in women's health also. Of course, prolapse in women occurs at later ages, not during the childbearing ages, you know, which is where we see it in sows. But there are a lot of common things, and then we can come back to that. And we've actually been contacted by researchers from the University of Utah who work in the human medical field and looking at the genetics of prolapse in women, because they had seen our research and saw a lot of parallels, even though there's a timing difference in when it occurs. There are a lot of parallels, and so we, as in human health, they can learn from the work we're doing, and we can learn from the work that they're doing. So that's another interesting aspect of this.
Thank you, Jack. We'll come back to some parallels you've noticed in your research between swine and humans, but in some of the past episodes, we've been able to assign a number to the economic loss from things like PERS, for example. Is there a number that we can use to measure the economic impact of POP across the industry?
I'm not aware of one, but you know, if you think of the incidence, and Janelle, you may have a better estimate of the incidence. You know, most of those prolapse sows, they have to be removed, right? And that's a huge cost, you know. Yeah, if you think of it that way, it's, you know, then you have to bring in a new gilt, a replacement, and raise that, and these sows, you know, they're at the parity where, you know, the litter size is larger, and so it is a huge cost. But yeah, I don't have a number. but it's substantial. Wouldn't be as high as PERS, but it is a substantial. And then, you know, and then there's the issue of animal welfare and the welfare of the farm workers, because it's a tough problem to have to deal with.
Janelle, anything you want to add there? Or
no, I think Jack covered that really well. And I think basically what it comes down to is that's a complicated number to derive, because there's so many factors that influence that number, right? One of the main ones being the parity at which the animal is removed, right? Because the general rule of thumb is that she has to make it to P3 in order to kind of pay for herself, so to speak. And so, a female who is removed before she farrows her first litter, that's an expensive loss, as is one that's removed after her first or second litter. And of course, much more detrimental than, let's say, an animal that ends up prolapsing at P6, which is, you know, around the time that she's probably going to end up being replaced, you know, anyway. So, yeah, a lot of factors involved in that, which makes it kind of complicated to put a number on it. But yeah, bottom line, it's an extremely devastating issue economically, but also from a welfare perspective, as Jack described.
And there may be other things that are related to it. You know, of course, we see the ones that prolapse, but even the ones that don't prolapse, there may be also consequences. Now, for example, we see a higher incidence of retained piglets that are not expelled. That might be related to that. We don't know yet, but that might be related to that, because one of the things that we see is that a sow that isn't able to provide the pelvic support may relate to just exhaustion, right? That the muscle structure may not be in good enough shape or run out of energy, right? And that may then also be related to not being able to expel those last piglets during farrowing. So there may be things related to this impact that are related to pelvic organ prolapse that we haven't made the connection yet, but there may be additional hidden things.
You mentioned Dr. Ross had started this project as part of the Swine Livability Program, and there's some continued developments since then. Walk us through what those developments have been and some of those industry components that have come to light since 2019.
Yeah, sure. So I can maybe start by just describing some of the initial analyses that we conducted internally within Topix Norsemen, and then maybe describe how Jack became involved and some of the analyses conducted there, which he can comment on that and the results from that work. So kind of picking up where we left off in terms of thinking of wanting to do our own internal investigation to looking at the genetic component. Actually, we were able to get started addressing that pretty quickly. And that's because we already had a data flow in the U.S. where we are routinely collecting data on sows that are reared under commercial conditions. So that data flow consists of pedigree information, genotypic information, and then very detailed phenotypic recording on these animals. And the nice aspect of this is because these animals are reared in a commercial U.S. environment, that these data are really representative of how these animals are responding and their performance levels in the midst of these environmental challenges that are associated with the modern pork production. And that's actually the data flow that we use to facilitate breeding value estimation for sow longevity and other robustness traits. So that's why that was in place, is we're already using that to generate information that's critical for our breeding program. So then using that data set, we could just simply extract the removal records for sows. And then we looked at analyzing prolapse as a binary trait. So whether that animal was removed due to POP or removed for another reason. And initially when we did these analyses, we just used the pedigree information to capture the genetic relatedness between individuals. And upon doing so, we found that the heritability of POP was estimated at 22%. And at this time, that was a pretty interesting finding, because up until that time point, it had generally been accepted that POP was not heritable or very, very lowly heritable. So this was a little bit of an interesting result in that time frame, coming out with this kind of announcement that POP appeared to have a moderate heritability. And kind of in discussion about those results, I think I ran into Jason at a conference or something, and we started talking about different factors associated with POP. And I mentioned this finding that we had come across, that there appears to be a moderate heritability for POP using the data set that we had analyzed. Quickly we came to realize that we had kind of this mutual interest in trying to understand the genetic basis further, also getting Jack involved in the conversation and saying, okay, how can we work together maybe to understand how to dig into understanding this genetic basis further? So at that point, Vishesh took the lead on the project in terms of analyzing the genetic data. So actually, it was the very same data set that we used to conduct the initial analysis, but with using the genotypic information, whereas we had just used the pedigree information. So he actually conducted an internship with us, where he spent some time in the Netherlands for a summer, also partially sponsored by the Pig Survivability Project. And his two main objectives were, first, to re-estimate heritability for POP using the genomic data, and then secondly, to identify genes or genomic regions associated with susceptibility to POP.
So just to clarify for our listeners, Vishesh was a PhD student under you, Jack. Can you share a little bit more about what you learned together?
Yeah, and so he, as Janelle said, spent some time in the Netherlands and then finished the analysis here, and that's been all been published. And we found that these pigs, they were genotyped for, 25,000 genetic markers across the genome. And so then you can get more accurate estimates of the relationships, or, you know, the part percentage of the genome that individuals or related individuals share, and that gives us more information than pedigree. And that based on that, those analyses, we found that the heritability was actually a little bit higher. One of the things you can do with genomics is sort out, when you use pooled semen, for example, who is the actual sire. You can't do that when you just have pedigree. So we found about 35%. It's a little bit complicated. It's on an underlying scale, you know, and if you convert it to what you actually see, whether a sow gets prolapse or not, it's over 10% of the differences are due to genetics, but that's still a substantial proportion of the differences between sows in whether they are prolapsing or not that appear to be affected by genetics. So genetics can be a solution. So by selection, you could reduce the frequency of pelvic organ prolapse, and that's of course the end goal. And then we also we looked at different types of analysis, and it was pretty consistent in terms of that there was a genetic basis. Now it may be because that this same line that was used, that these data were collected on one of the maternal lines of Topix norsfin. In other farms or in other countries, they may not show prolapse. So there is a definite strong impact of environment. And of course, one of the goals of Jason Ross's work on prolapse was to look at the environment side, the management side. But then, as Janelle said, the other thing that you can do with this data, if you have the animals genotyped for mileage markers across the genome, you can look at which parts of the genome create these genetic differences in the the risk of getting prolapse. And so he did that, and he found some regions, and then you can look at what genes are in those regions, and found a number of genes that biologically make a lot of sense that they should be related to prolapse based on what we know about prolapse, not only from pigs but also humans and other species. And so some of the regions were related to genes that are involved with reproductive hormones, estrogen, progesterone. And we know that those are reproductive hormones. They are associated with reproduction, but they also are associated with a lot of things around reproduction. During farrowing, the ability to have strong pelvic support, especially in humans, that's been found. Those same genes have been found to be important for the risk of prolapse in humans. So if there's not a strong pelvic floor support, there's a greater risk of prolapse. Things related to collagen, fibroblast, elastin, those types of genes showed up, and they all make sense when it comes to thinking about that the pelvic floor needs to support the organs that sit on top of it. And if that's weakened, you can have a higher increase of prolapse. Things related to the immune system. So it's also known that immune response is related to the probability of getting prolapse. And again, that comes from humans. There are a lot of things that biologically made sense. And individually, those genes may not have a big effect, but they also then may point to things that can be done in terms of nutrition or in terms of management to reduce the risk of prolapse. So, for example, one of the genes, a couple of the genes that showed up are related to regulation of calcium. And calcium is related to bone strength and so on. And it's also been the level of calcium has actually been shown to be associated with prolapse in beef cattle. So beef cattle that have a low level of calcium around calving, they have a higher risk of prolapse. And so all of that makes a lot of sense. And so now nutritionists can look at, well, what if we increase the calcium level in the feed or do something else to preserve calcium or the uptake of calcium? Does that reduce the incidence of prolapse? So these studies not only have an importance in terms of what can you do in terms of genetic selection, but then they can also give us clues into things you could change in terms of nutrition or management that may help to address this issue of prolapse. So a lot of interesting results. And like I said, the human geneticists have picked up on this and contacted us. So now looking at a collaboration with them, comparing the results that we get from our studies with the results that they get from their genomic studies on prolapse in women.
As you look at nutritionists using some of this information, there were some follow-up studies done using Vishesh's work that helped producers. Share a little bit more of an outline of how this information actually was disseminated and distributed to producers.
Yeah, so just thinking about some of the highlights from Vishesh's work, Jack, you already mentioned it, but maybe just to reiterate, his work confirmed that there was a genetic basis upon analysis of these data, and that actually the heritability of POP was even greater than what we had realized with our initial analysis using the pedigree data. So Vishesh's conclusion being that heritability was actually estimated at 35% versus the 22% that we had previously reported. And then as Jack also mentioned, the identification that the genetic basis of POP is very complex. So not just that it's complicated. Yeah, it's a complicated trait. But what we mean by that is, as Jack alluded to, the genetic basis is really due to a number of regions having small effects on the trait of interest. And that's actually really important for the implications for us as a breeding program or a breeding company in terms of how we can implement those findings. Because traits that are due to a single gene, you know, provide the option of using a single gene selection to make selection decisions. That's not the case here. We really need to take advantage of all of the different regions that are impacting the trait to quantify that as a breeding value, which we then use to select against prolapse. But all of the work that we've described so far was conducted using purebred information. And of course, one of the relevant things for the industry is that most of the animals that are in commercial production are crossbreds. And so one of the follow-up questions that we had was, well, how does the heritability compare in a crossbred population versus a purebred population? And at the same time, you know, are there factors that we can investigate further with some extra data collection while we're investigating the heritability of POP and crossbreds that can actually be used to validate the impact of some of these factors that were identified from Jason Ross's study? So that's the basis of a follow-up project that we initiated last summer, so in 2023. We hired an intern to work on that project, and that intern is Trisha Veldhuizen, who at the time was doing her undergraduate work at Iowa State and is now actually doing her master's with Jack, which she will probably elaborate on in a bit. She did all kinds of data collection in that summer where she collected data on almost 4,000 sows, actually. She was very productive. And she recorded a body condition score, caliper score, perineal score, and also tissue sample collection on females as they were going into the farrowing unit. And I've done some initial analyses looking at these phenotypes and have observed that have body condition score actually has a very significant impact on perineal score and susceptibility to prolapse. And so that was really in direct response to validating the finding from Jason Ross's work that body condition is one of those significant non-genetic factors for POP. So we were able to confirm that, the lower the body condition, so the thinner the sow, the more susceptible to prolapse and the worse perineal score. So she's now going to be working on doing some follow-up analyses with those data, including doing the genetic investigation of those data.
So maybe I can add to that. So the perineal score was a scoring system that Jason Ross's group developed as part of this part of the National Pork Board Survivability Project. Basically scoring the perineal area. I think it's a scale 1 to 3, I think. And they did find that, the ones that scored a 3 were more at a higher risk or at a higher probability of actually developing prolapse. And with this new data, so on the original data that Vishesh analyzed, the perineal score was not collected, but it was by Tricia on these new data. So we'll also be able to look at how heritable is that scoring system, and can we use that to select for sows that have lower risk of developing prolapse. Potentially, farmers, going back to your question of what can farmers do with this, farmers could do that scoring and based on that scoring identify sows that they have to keep a close eye on, and maybe, as Janelle said, body condition, do things to improve their body condition or the farm in general. One of the things with prolapse and with many diseases, there's no silver bullet. Of course, you can't vaccinate for it. It's not a pathogen. But there's also not a single thing that fixes it, right? And because the reason for prolapse may be slightly different in one farm than another farm, okay? And there's still a lot of research that needs to be done to really pinpoint, you know, for a particular farm, what's the reason and how can you fix that? The research we've done so far, also from the genetic side, points to a lot of things that could be important, right? But then we actually have to test whether fixing that from a management or nutrition standpoint does indeed make things better from a prolapse standpoint. So, so this new data that Tricia will be analyzing is going to give us more information on the perineal score. It as Janelle said, it's on the commercial animal, not the purebred animal. Going to give us a lot more information on that would be more directly relevant to the producers. Okay, but also then gives information to the breeding side on what how to select the purebreds to get crossbred animals that are have lower risk of developing prolapse.
So I know you mentioned that there's not a silver bullet and every farm looks different, but do you find that there is either a genetic or a non-genetic factor that is most impactful in cases where you see POP, or is there one that's maybe weighted heavier than others?
Well, as Janelle also mentioned, that there's it's not a single gene. So also from a genetic standpoint, it's not, you can't say, well, just get an animal that has this genetic makeup for this gene. It's many genes, right? And so what breeding companies can do is using this data and all the pedigree and the genetic data that they have, the genotypes, the marker genotypes, they can estimate breeding values of boars and of sows, of females, for risk to prolapse. And then through selection, over time, reduce the probability of prolapse in the progeny. Yeah, and that's the approach that breeding companies will take. Then there's still the question, is the same genetic if you select for genetic improvement to reduce prolapse, does that reduce prolapse in all the farms, or are there specific environments where you need to select on different things? Right. And so there's still quite a bit of work that needs to be done. But, this is a very, very important start and things that breeding companies can start implementing. But then you have to monitor to see what happens at the commercial level in different environments, in different management systems.
Is there anything else you'd like to add to today's conversation?
No, the other thing that I wanted to add is that I think this is a good example where the collaboration between, the industry side and academics, funding from the pork board, from producers, how that can come together to address a problem that affects the whole industry, right? And where a company like Topix Norsfin is willing to then also, share that information, right? Because they could have done all that work in-house, right? And not tell anybody about it, but it's an important industry-wide issue that now also other partners in the industry can make use of this knowledge. So that's very important.
Yeah, maybe just a couple closing thoughts, I guess, from my side is maybe just to summarize a little bit to the course of the conversation that we've had is, first and foremost, all of this work validates that we saw that POP is heritable, has a genetic basis. And then the question is, what do we do with that? So identifying that POP has a genetic basis means that we can address susceptibility to POP through the breeding program. And I hinted at this a little bit earlier in terms of different selection strategies. But the approach that we're taking is to estimate breeding values for POP by making use of all of the variation impacting POP spread across the genome. Actually, we've been selecting for enhanced sow longevity for over a decade. So that, you know, by definition includes susceptibility to POP as well as other causes of sow death loss. So I've seen that strategy of selecting for enhanced sow longevity has already been beneficial in addressing susceptibility to POP, as we would expect. But we did make the decision actually to add POP as its own trait to the index after this initial investigation that I described. So that was in January of 2021. So now it's kind of a twofold approach of selecting for enhanced sow longevity as well as direct selection against susceptibility to POP specifically. It's like, maybe is that redundant? Well, in a way, but the thought behind that is that adding POP as its own trait will actually increase the rate of genetic improvement that we can make for that particular trait. So I think these are the types of approaches that are important to consider for genetics companies is, yeah, okay, now we've got breeding values for POP that we can address that directly. But there are still all these other causes of sow death loss. So selecting for enhanced sow longevity is still very relevant and important. And I think as we understand more and more about some of these other major causes of sow death loss, you know, we're going to need to take a similar strategy in terms of thinking about how we can make even more genetic improvement in addressing those causes. But Jack and I get excited about the genetic component because we're geneticists, but I think, also very important to recognize is that a heritability of 35%, even in this case, still indicates that the majority of the phenotypic variation in POP is due to non-genetic factors. So still very important and relevant for us to keep our eye on identifying and mitigating those non-genetic factors. This data set of Tricia, I think, is a good example of that, where we see that, body condition score yet again appears to be a very relevant factor. And as Jack mentioned, that is something tangible that the producer can kind of take ownership of and say, all right, I know that a sow that's too thin going into gestation, going into farrowing is a risk factor for POP. And so that's something that I can also kind of take ownership of, that, you know, together with the genetic supplier and the producer can work on addressing this issue kind of from both sides.
That's it for the December episode of the PigX podcast. Today we heard ways that producers and stakeholders can look for POP and how it can be prevented. It'll be interesting to hear Jack's future collaboration with prolapses on the human side as we bring you the latest research and what's happening in the swine industry. We once again want to thank Dr. Jack Deckers and Dr. Janelle Dunkelberger for joining today's conversation. And thank you all for tuning in to the latest episode of the PigX podcast. Be sure to come back next year for another timely episode on all things swine. Until then, I'm Delaney Howell, and this has been the PigX podcast.
PigX is a national podcast hosted by the Pig Livability Project partners at Iowa State University, Kansas State University, and Purdue, and supported by the Iowa Pork Industry Center. For more information on the project, head to www.piglivability.org, or to inquire directly with questions regarding the project, email ipic.iastate.edu. PigX, ideas in the swine industry worth sharing.